Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Tuesday. Today we're talking with USCFootball.com beat writer and columnist Dan Weber, who knows everything that's been going on around this USC football team. It's been interesting, to say the least. I want to talk about Utah, get to a lot of your questions. If you have any questions for us, drop us an email, podcast@uscfootball.com, or leave us a voicemail, 641-715-3900 is our number, and extension 816-646, or you can go to our website, peristylepodcast.com. Click on the left side of the page from your device or your computer, and you can leave a voicemail that way as well. Of course, you can go to itunes.com/peristylepodcast. We've been getting a lot of reviews in, everyone giving us 5 stars. We love it. Keep doing that. It helps boost the show and you know, increases our reach. It really helps us a lot to go to iTunes and subscribe to the show and review it and give us a good rating. We really appreciate you guys doing that. Lots of great feedback from that. And just want to let people know on the questions, we got a bunch of complaints. We want to try to make sure all your voicemail questions have to be under a minute. We won't play them. Please don't send me 2 pages worth of written stuff for your email questions. I can't read all that stuff. It just takes a long time. We're getting so many questions in. If you send a long question, we're probably not going to read it. So please try to keep it short, keep it concise, and be specific of who you want the question to. Today, the questions will all be for Dan Weber, who's right here. What's up, Dan? How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. It's a lot more fun to be talking about what happened last Saturday than the week before, or the week before.
Yeah, very true. And we actually, usually we get so many questions after a loss, which we did, and we set records. We got a whole bunch of questions even after this win, too. So people are interested, Dan. And I want to start you out with some questions, but just wanted to thank our sponsor first for the Tuesday show, Michael Moline Real Estate. We got to run into Michael again Saturday against Utah in the press box. He, of course, does all the he helps out with the stats on the big stats team that USC has there. But if you're in SoCal, you need some help with real estate, Michael can definitely help you out. So go to michaelmolinerealestate.com or call him at 310-275-4688. And we'll have more information, a little ad at the end of the show, too, if you want to get more information on Michael. And Dan, I thought this was an interesting question to, or comment, I guess we could start off with and get your thoughts on it. So here we go.
Chris from Delaware, your absolute biggest fan. Ryan, king of USC. My question is for Dan. Dan, I've been out of the country for about 3 weeks. I'm sure it's been pretty humdrum around there, but if you could give me a quick synopsis, you could leave out the Washington game. I'm sure that was a rout. Sarks really got their number. And it's hard to imagine that. At one time, we were actually thinking about hiring Chris Peterson. That'll teach everybody out there to second-guess Pat Hayden. Guys, he's not the best AD in the country on accident. So that leaves Notre Dame and Utah, which when I left, Utah was very, very good. So that couldn't have been easy. Isn't it going to be crazy, Dan, if you said that we lost to Washington, but yet we beat third-ranked Utah? Which would lead me to say, obviously, that sounds like bad coaching and bad management. But I'm sure that didn't happen. Thanks, guys. So happy to be out of Siberia and back to a place where things make sense. Fight on.
I'm not sure for Cliff in Delaware. I don't know what more we need to say. Cliff got it all right. He didn't have to ask a question at all. I mean, you don't want to try to predict. This is why I purposely don't predict games. Although I will say this, when the spot went from 3.5 point USC favored over number 3 and unbeaten Utah to 6.5 point spot on Saturday, I thought, you know what? You could make that case. It clearly was a case that could be made. If you looked at how they played Notre Dame with about 2.5 practices under Clay Helton, you know, that was pretty darn competitive. The 21 straight points going ahead 31-24, you know, at the after three quarters pretty much. That was a pretty competitive USC football team against a Notre Dame team that really played well and you know, had a great crowd behind him and all that. So you had to think, you know, if they got another week and they figure out some things and start doing some things, probably running the ball the way they need to run it, not the way they were trying to run it all the time. If they, you know, if they just, you know, get themselves, you know, stop doing the things that hurt themselves, you know, then you'd say, okay, they've got a chance. Now, I was talking to Coach Bob Conley today, the offensive line coach, and he said, though, however, if you'd have said, we're going to be able to run the ball and probably be able to pick up the blitzes pretty well against a really good Utah defense, and we're going to do that without Max Turk, without Chad Wheeler, without Toa Lobodon, he didn't even finish that sentence. It's just like, you know, how do you do that? How do you have a third-string center come in and pretty much play flawlessly in Khalil Rogers? How do you have Zach Banner go to left tackle and, you know, start a true freshman at right tackle and survive and score 42 points on top of it? Well, you know, it helps if you get a true freshman with three interceptions and one of them, you know, a pick six. But, don't try to make too much sense out of any of this or try to even, you know, get ahead of it. Just probably, hopefully from now on, you just sit back and enjoy it and see what happens. I mean, on Tuesday's practice, this team has the capacity to get better and to build. It looked like today's practice, they built on Saturday's game. That's what you want, that they're trusting one another. They're trusting their coaches. And, you know, that's where you get to be a good football team. When you trust what you're doing, you trust the guy next to you, you trust the coach that's calling the plays. I know Cody was saying he likes, you know, getting under center, for example, now. And said to Clay, hey, just call the play. I'll do it any way you want me to. We'll make it happen. We'll make plays. And that's kind of what they're doing. So, don't try to outguess what's going to happen. Just try to figure out, how you're going to enjoy it, the rest of the way and hope they keep playing this way.
All right. Let's go to John, in Brea, California. He says the Peristyle podcast has changed my life. Wow. John, thank you. I feel sorry for your life. No, I'm just kidding. But thank you. I'm glad that we could to help you. He says, many thanks to you and your guests for putting this together each week. My question's for Dan Weber. The last time we went through this with Coach O, there were a few players that emerged from the doghouse and were given a chance after languishing on the bench for whatever reason. Buck Allen is the prime example. This time with Coach Helton, have you noticed anyone getting significant playing time and contributing that otherwise would be on the bench if Steve Sarkisian was still the coach? Thanks again. Fight on, John and Brea.
Well, I mean, I think just one was just because of, you know, the injury to Toa Lobodon. You got Khalil Rogers. I don't think we ever understood why Khalil wasn't getting his chances. He had some injuries and, you know, this and that, but he always looked like a guy who could play the way he played Saturday. And he never really got that chance. I think, you know, he got one start and he got hurt. And then, you know, something always seemed to happen. But, you know, there he was just waiting to, you know, to get that chance. And darned if he didn't get it and take every advantage of it. I think what's going to happen now, and Clay talked about this today, and this is one of the things I think we have to give Steve Sarkisian credit for, is he played a lot of guys. And he played people I don't think because they had been recruited with high, you know, big reputations and all that. He played guys because, you know, there wasn't much to choose from between, say, the incoming freshmen and some of the, you know, the upperclassmen and all that. And they just gave them all a chance. And I think Clay said today that's starting to pay off because when you start losing guys the way, you know, you lose a Marvell Tell or, you end up with a couple of tight ends that can't finish the game, and, you know, Trey Madden can't start the game. All of those things. I mean, I think a lot of the things they did for this team to get a lot of those guys early game action, you know, will pay off, you know, from here on out. So I don't know that I really don't think necessarily there was anybody in the doghouse. I think, you know, previously there was a doghouse, and I don't know, question, Buck was in it. And some of it was just if you were not recruited highly by somebody, you know, then, you know, recruiting was such a big deal. I don't know that, that this team has any of those kinds of, you know, doghouse players. But I do think they're, you know, I had a list, I think, of 11 yesterday that guys that very possibly are going to get their chance and more by circumstances and injuries than anything. But I don't think there's a, I don't know, Ryan. Can you think of a doghouse guy? I'm not sure.
The only one I could think of is like Quentin Powell, like was kind of had a weird reason for not being on the field, but we haven't really seen him again. So maybe that was a legitimate reason, but he was one guy I thought of.
Yeah, I mean, he's every day he flashes and, you know, does something. I mean, he gets places quickly and he makes plays. Now that, you know, they work on the, you know, the punting a lot and punt coverage and all that kind of thing, and he's going to make plays in space, and I think he's always going to do that, you know, whether he'll find a regular spot. I mean, one of the problems is there are so many linebackers. I mean, they just have a whole lot of linebackers that it's not that easy, you know, for a guy or a Michael Hutchings, those guys to, you know, find a place out there where there's enough, you know, playing time. Other than, you know, on special teams. And I do think, you know, I think some of the guys you might see and we're seeing more of are walk-ons who, like a James Tolan, Joel Foy, you know, we always knew that George Katribe and Robbie Collins and those guys were going to contribute. But I think you're seeing, you know, Ruben Peters, for example, you're seeing more of those guys in you know, on special teams coverage in roles like that. And, you know, they've been doing a heck of a job. So that might be one of the places you'll see guys show up. But, again, not doghouse guys, just guys that are going to get a chance that maybe, you know, hadn't gotten one before.
Tarek had a question for us. He said, will we keep seeing the aggression on the defensive line going forward that has been absent all season?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they said they didn't do anything differently. They really did. I mean, it's stuff that they've always had, you know, that they could have been doing. You know, they're doing more twists and more, you know, stunts. And I think Sean Cody was talking about it the other day. He liked the fact that they were blitzing a time or two when it wasn't an obvious passing down. It was just, you know, strictly a run situation, and they were getting people in all the gaps. And, you know, they were just clogging up the, you know, the run lanes, and they were actually getting, you know, penetration, you know, and against the best running back that they, you know, played against all year. And you just think that will build on itself, you know, that they can't avoid, you know, with having that kind of success against Devontae Booker, you got to think, okay, we get these guys. I mean, the thing I didn't like about the way they approached the defense is they weren't getting people moving. They weren't getting him in motion, and this is not, you know, most USC teams that we've seen that have been successful aren't successful by just sitting there and waiting and hoping, you know, that they can react when, you know, the play starts and all that. And that whole idea of, you know, playing the game on your side of the line of scrimmage just doesn't work. And by getting these guys moving, getting them, you know, through the gaps, you know, working on penetration, they didn't get – that many sacks on Travis Wilson, but they certainly put, you know, made him uncomfortable. They, you know, the thing that they really said they wanted to do against Kevin Hogan and Stanford and didn't do at all, they did make it work against Travis Wilson. So you would think we're going to see that the rest of the way. That just, you know, was exactly what this team needs to be doing. And it's hard to imagine they won't, you know, do more of that and just, you know, build on that Utah game. I mean, that's the great thing about a game like the Utah game, and a little bit about the Notre Dame game where they at least did it for about 36 minutes, is you can build on that. And the kids build on it themselves, I think. And so I do think, yeah, you're going to see more of that.
Nick just wanted to know about updates on any of the injured players.
Okay. Both of the tight ends, you know, they kind of got lucky. I think Taylor McNamara's had a dislocated shoulder before. The last time it had a he had a torn labrum with it, and this time no torn labrum, no surgery needed. He was out there in his yellow no contact jersey, but feeling pretty good. And he said he thinks he can go contact tomorrow, at least some. But he said he's pretty much good to go. Tyler Petit got his foot stepped on, a lot of pain, no break. That was one of those ones. I thought that would have been the most potential, you know, when you get your foot really, you know, crunched and, you know, there are just so many bones there that, you know, you can get a break and there's just nothing you can do. Well, they got a break and he didn't break it. He had a lot of pain in it today. So he wasn't in football cleats, but he was out there and, you know, full pads. And I think he's got a pretty good shot at being able to go back to Northern California and play against, his almost home, I guess, guys.
Yeah.
Marvell Tell out in shorts and jersey. He's got a broken collarbone. He's going to be out minimum 6 weeks. So he's going to be a guy, you know, if they can get in a championship game, maybe, he could get back. Let's see. Rasheem Green banged up his knee, but it must be more of a, you know, a pain issue and just a bruise. And they were working with him on some rehab stuff, but he was out, in, you know, in full gear. We didn't see Trey Madden. That sore knee has just really been limiting him. I thought Kevon Seymour had a really good practice, and he looks like he's pretty much back. As far as the two wide receivers, I had heard that they might be 85% back, Stephen Mitchell with his sprained ankle and Darius Rogers with his quad. He's got a hamstring. And he didn't look that far back. I mean, they did run some patterns, not much. Darius got out there late. I'm thinking it's about a 50-50 for them this weekend. I mean, I think, you know, there's a chance. You wouldn't want to absolutely predict it at this point. I don't think we know where they are. I think that gets us pretty much up to date on and Chad Wheeler cleared from the, you know, the concussion syndrome, full go, ready to go. Everything is so he's back at left tackle with Zach Banner going back to right tackle.
All right. Thanks for that. We have a voicemail question for you. Here you go.
Hey, Ryan. Andrew from D.C. Question for you and Dan Weber. I know that turnovers are a part of the game, but Arizona State and Utah, a lot of similarities there in that we won big because of our ability to win the turnover battle by a large margin. Going in Arizona State, perhaps more of the luckier variety. Going forward, my question is, can we win a big game, a tough game, without winning the turnover battle by a large margin? Thanks a lot.
Well, I mean, I think the key there is you don't give it away. You don't necessarily, I don't know that you have to absolutely win it by a large margin, but you better not lose it. I think that, you know, they've got to, and I think they've been, you know, they've taken care of the ball pretty well with Cody. I think the way they're, you know, running the offense now with more, you know, under center, and then more giving Cody the option to really, you know, if they back off on Juju, for example, or Adoree, to take that, you know, that wide receiver screen. They're blocking it pretty well. It's pretty much a run play the way they're doing it now. They're moving the chains, and that's pretty safe stuff. So I think the way they're taking care of the ball, and you know, Pete's team's, we didn't ever consider it an aberration when they won the turnover battle. And this team, I mean, I did like all year long. I thought they really thought about turnovers. They talked, you know, if we're giving Sark credit, I think that was another thing that, you know, I think he had the right emphasis on, you know, the whole Pete thing that it's all about the ball. And, you know, obviously they've got some guys like Cameron Smith who just has a knack. I mean, he's a linebacker, a freshman linebacker who can drop into coverage and still, you know, keep his eyes on the quarterback. And that's, I know they talk that a lot. Coach Sermon with the linebackers really talks about, you know, keeping their heads up, keeping their eyes, open and alert and all that, that you're seeing that that play out. So, but yeah, it's obviously if they get the big turnover margin, they've got a great opportunity. And this is one of the things we haven't been seeing very much of without winning those turnover battles is you don't get the short fields. And what a difference when you give yourself, you know, a couple of short fields and you know, the way that picks up the offense. And I think the thing that you saw Saturday is the offense did the defense a lot of favors with four, you know, fairly long drives. And the defense doesn't have to be out there all the time. And then the defense goes out and gets the ball back for the offense. And that stuff we haven't been seeing. That stuff we just haven't been seeing. And that, again, takes you back a decade as to that was the old formula. I think the combination of those two things, I think the long drives with the offense, you know, helps the defense. You don't have to, you know, necessarily, you know, get a takeaway. But you know, the two working together, I think, are the keys as much as anything. But they'll take the takeaways, that's for sure.
Yeah. Chris had a question, Dan. He said, I noticed Saturday, right off the bat, USC used corner and safety blitzes. I also noticed more stunts up front. Although the secondary didn't get a sack, I believe that these different looks contributed to the problems Wilson had passing the football and also helped when we only rushed three and actually got a sack with a three-man rush. Do you agree? Why is it taking so long to use some different packages and stunts? Is it possible Sark didn't want to or that Clay Helton told Wilcox to do it? The pressure on the QB was the difference in this game versus our losses. Your thoughts, Chris?
Chris, I think the first thing they wanted to do was basically force Wilson to throw the ball, and which meant they had to stop Booker. I think to stop Booker, they really had to get penetration, however they could do that, whether they were bringing guys from the secondary, whether they were, you know, twisting or stunting guys up front, whether they're bringing linebackers, whatever they could do. I mean, they don't do, you know, they still don't do a lot of it. I mean, not an over, you know, compared to some teams, but I just think they knew they had to be moving. They had to, you know, plug gaps. And then, you know, I think they feel, and I thought, I like the idea. They had a really clear game plan in mind. Whenever anybody you talk to, everybody on defense said, if we can force him, you know, force Wilson to throw the ball, we win the game. So they absolutely wanted to take Booker out of the game. And it's the thing that's driving the, you know, the Utah fans crazy because he only carried it 14 times. And they're like, what happened? What happened? Well, when you're down 28-17 at half, you're down a couple of scores. It's really hard to grind the ball out, you know, and you give up the, you know, USC got the ball to start the second half. That was really a tough situation for a team that, you know, likes to grind it out. So I think they did a lot of things that all, you know, worked well. But you're right. They did a lot of different things. I don't think we could ever get a good answer as to why weren't they doing those things. Was it a, you know, we've talked this, you know, today about there's so much more trust on this team, trust between the players, trust of the coaches. The coaches trusting the players to do the right thing. I mean, there's just that sense, and I don't think that sense of trust was there earlier in the season. And, you know, we can all, you know, maybe psychoanalyze exactly what was going on, you know, that there wasn't that trust there, but it wasn't there. And so they tended to kind of sit on things because they maybe didn't trust people to, you know, to get the job done. But you just have to. You got to trust that, you know, this is what we're going to do and everybody's going to do it right. And I think the thing that they talked about, the difference between this game and the Notre Dame game, was there were a lot, you know, a lot of missed assignments on defense against Notre Dame. And that's why that game flipped around so much, where they, you know, held them for so long and then all of a sudden they didn't hold them at all. Clay said that he thought there was just one missed assignment on defense the entire game. That's amazing.
Yeah, wow.
So if that happens, you then can trust them to do some things. So, let, you know, again, hope that that is the, you know, the pattern going forward is, yeah, we trust you guys to, you know, get the job done, and everybody's going to be on the right page, you know, same page. Everybody's going to do the same thing. And we won't have to, you know, maybe, oh, let's don't do that because what if so-and-so doesn't do it right? Or what if so, well, I think they're past that. Now, you just have to go out and play. This is our best shot. I mean, who would have ever thought you can bring in your third string, you know, center who hadn't even gotten to snap the ball once the whole week, because they'd moved him to guard. And, he's going to do, you know, the kind of job Khalil Rogers did. I mean, again, you just got to trust him. You got a lot of talent on this team. I mean, I think that's one of the things that was kind of bugging me a little bit about people, writing in and, you know, saying, we just got to face it. This team doesn't have much talent. This team just, you know, they're not that good.
Yeah, I never bought that.
Huh?
Never bought that.
No, I mean, you know, and the Utah kids were just saying, man, you know, they picked up all our blitzes. They did this. They did, you know, I mean, and they obviously gave Booker the worst game he's had all year by far. And they weren't doing the right things. I don't think there's any question about it. Why that was, we never got a really good answer as to why that was, and now it isn't. And I guess you could say, well, they weren't doing the right things, and now there's a new coach, and they're doing the right things the last couple of weeks, huh? And practice, I think they're doing more fundamental stuff. I mean, they're letting the defensive coaches coach them more technique, and not a lot of time, but just enough time to start practice when they, you know, work on, you know, stances and staying under control and angled tackling and shedding blockers. And you know, it's not a lot of time, but it's just a reinforcement. You know, you see guys now, for example, on the sidelines working on their pass rush moves, their swim moves or whatever, and, you know, showing one another. You'll see a couple of defensive linemen doing that. And that's stuff we hadn't been seeing. And this is where you see a team where maybe they take responsibility into their own hands more and more, that they're going to be free to make plays, and it's up to them to make the plays. And I think we're seeing more of that, and I think you're seeing the results that guys are able to make. And that game, as it went on, you saw guys taking more and more responsibility, you know, for what they were doing, and doing it pretty well.
Let's go to Jeff in Fountain Valley. Dan, he said, am I right in noticing that most of the completed passes USC gives up are coming against the zone defense, but all of the pass interference penalties they've given up have come on man defense? I don't know if you noticed that. I didn't really, but get your thoughts, Dan.
I think that's generally true. And I do think, you know, at times the complaint about, you know, zone is, man, you know, it's zone, but it's not prevent. And I think there really is that, you know, that difficulty in knowing exactly what can you give up and, you know, what won't you give up and how do you get there from here, you know, if you're playing behind them. I do think, they do have to work on, how they're using, I mean, they talked a lot about it last week about how they're using their hands. And I think, you know, only of the two on Biggie, I think only one of those was a real pass interference. I thought, you know, they were both involved. I thought he had better position on the one where he got called for it. But, you know, you get a reputation in the Pac-12, and it's sure a lot easier just to call what you've seen on film than to actually call what you see. And you know, it's the Pac-12, and you just got to, you know, if the ball's up in the air, there's any kind of contact, they get nervous, and they think, you know, they got to throw that flag. So they just have to be, you know, a little bit smarter than that. But, you know, again, this game, or just the five penalties. So I think USC will take that, you know, any day and you know, learn from it and go on. But, yeah, and I think that would be the norm, that you're going to see more pass interference on man, and you're going to see more, you know, underneath completions on the zone. I mean, that's just the deal. When you play those, you know, that's the trade-off. You know, you're going to, you have, and that's why they pay the defensive coordinators the big bucks to make that, you know, that call and figure out which is, you know, which is percentage-wise the best, the better call. And I don't know that there's anything you can do about that. You just have to, you know, technique-wise, just get a little bit better. But this is, they're working at it. This is a team that, you know, they want to be good. And, you know, they're still pretty darn young. And, you know, they didn't let Utah really get away from them, though. They, you know, you had those moments, but you didn't ever have the sense that, you know, other than the one punt return and a couple of those, you know, breakdowns like that, you didn't have any sense that USC was kind of letting Utah, you know, get away from them at all.
Matt had a question. He said, make sure Dan Weber gets credit, the credit he deserves, for telling us about two spring practices in that Cameron Smith was much better with his cover skills than expected and was going to be a player. Thank you both for all the great work. Beat Cal, from Matt.
Thank you for remembering. Yeah, I was pretty much stunned. Cause, we know what we know, and we watch, you know, video. And you know, I try not to watch too much until the kid is absolutely coming, and then you want to see what you see. But I'm not sure that we got to see enough. And some of that is who they're playing in high school and do they throw the ball and all of the things. So, you know, I don't think we knew. How does he turn his hips, and how does he play in space? I mean, Peter Sermon didn't know. We were talking to him after the game, and he said, I didn't know he could do that. I wasn't sure. Because, you know, at first there were, you know, the thought that, is this just a two-down guy? And third down, he's got to come out. But when you watch him watch the football, when you watch him jump the route, when you – he did – I mean, the one interception, he reminded you of Matt Grudegood when he kind of – Matt Grudegood used to purposely, like, look away so that the quarterback would think he wasn't even looking, and he knew where the ball was coming. And then Lova Tatupa did that too. And he's doing it better than anybody since then. I mean, I haven't seen anybody that could, you know, look like he's maybe not in the play, and he knows exactly – And one of the things he's really good at feeling where that tight end is behind him. He just seems to have, you know, the old, you know, cliche, eyes in the back of his head. He just has a feel, you know, for it. And, you know, he's kind of leaning one way. And the next thing, I mean, on the one interception, he broke well before Wilson threw the ball. He knew where the ball was going because he knew there was only one receiver in the area. He knew where that guy was going to be. And, but he did that you know, every quarterback on this team, I think, in the spring.
Yeah.
I mean, and he did it one night to Sam Darnold in the summer. He did it like two or three straight times. It was like, I'm not sure it was Darnold. It might have been, gosh, I'm thinking of
Ricky Town.
The trans? Yeah. Anyway, that's right. It was. And, he's just, it's no surprise. I mean, the only thing is, I guess he dropped a couple earlier in the year and they were all on him, you know, for, you know, go to the jug machine and start catching the ball and all that. But it was never a case of, he wasn't going to be in the right place. I mean, his only thought was, he said the other night, was just make sure I catch it because he's going to be in the area. And, I don't even know if you can teach that, and I'm not even sure you can coach it. You just get out of his way and free him up to make those kinds of plays. And, I mean, I think that's what Pete's defenses did, is they freed guys like Grudegood and Tatupu to make those kinds of plays, and Troy Polamalu, obviously. But that's what they certainly did with him, and you got to give everybody credit for putting him in places where he can do, you know, what he did Saturday. But yeah, this is not a surprise having watched him, you know, in the spring and the summer. And thanks for remembering.
Yeah. Here's a voicemail question for you.
Hey, guys. How are you? This message is for Dan Weber. This is Don from the East Coast, right on. I'm calling because I wanted you guys to kind of take a look at what I noticed this week is that the reason why we were able to win the game, not just because of the defense, but because we were able to play with a balance. We didn't put so much pressure on Cody, and due to the run game giving us balance, it pretty much opened up the passes. And I noticed also, too, he was kind of, you know, hit the tight end a couple of times with some crossing patterns. And to me, if USC continues to do that, there's no one that's going to be able to stop us. I think that if we use the run game to set up the pass as opposed to the pass setting up the run game, that's pretty much how we can be. And I think we can be great like that. I just hope that they continue to do so. Just want to see your guys' perspective on that. Once again, you guys are doing an awesome job. Fight on all day, every day from the East Coast. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, good observations from the East Coast. I think this USC football, there was a classic pattern. And I don't know that there are a lot of teams that can do it. You know, you look at Alabama, Notre Dame, Michigan, those kinds of programs. You think Texas ought to be able to do it. But there are programs, I think, that can play kind of old-style classic football where they line up, where they knock you off the line of scrimmage, where they run right at you. You know, they hit stuff in there quickly. They run sweeps. They run pitches. They try to outnumber you at the edge. And then when you get so, you know, focused on the fact that you better be able to stop the run, then they throw the ball on you. They throw play action. And you know, it's not, you're not reinventing the wheel here. I mean, you're just, this is the way it works. And USC is going back to kind of old-style classic USC football. They're still not throwing it to the tight end yet. But other than that, and they are doing more of the wide receiver screen stuff, but they're running it more as a running play and as a safe running play. If teams are going to give it to you, you got to take it. You don't take it. I mean, this is some of the, I think, that people, when people went crazy with the bubble screen, when it was forced, when they were throwing it when they didn't have an advantage. You just don't do that. And you got to run it as a real running play with blockers so that you've got, you know, the advantage at the point of attack. But yeah, I think the balance in, you know, has always been the case. If USC could run the ball, they're going to be able to throw the ball. I mean, they've got too much talent at quarterbacks and wide receivers to not be able to, you know, throw the ball if they're, you know, successfully, you know, running the ball. So I think the key was, you know, the other night is what they exactly said was the way it happened. If they could stop the run and take the ball out of Booker's hands and make Wilson try to beat him, and if they could run the ball themselves, they win the game. And that's exactly what happened. But I think with you in USC's case, if they can run the ball successfully, they're going to throw it well as well. And that formula is going to work. I mean, and you're exactly right. That balance is exactly what they need.
Yeah, the rest of the questions, well, we had one like Todd. Well, maybe we'll do that one first. We had a McNair one and then some coaching stuff, AD and coaching things. But I'll do the McNair one. We haven't talked about it in a while. And then we'll get into the coaching stuff. John said, with the McNair lawsuit, if he wins, what can USC gain out of it? And can they get the championship back and all the victories for Coach Carroll back? This is my question because they are screwed when it comes to the scholarships. I really think they should have contested everything in court. Here I go again. Thanks, Ryan, from John.
Yeah, John, I mean, you can't get them back if you don't ask for them. And I don't mean, please, sir, can we have them back? You have to ask for them in a way that, you know, where they realize, as Penn State did, where they realized Penn State had them. The NCAA made up, you know, as vile and awful as everything that happened at Penn State was, the NCAA had no business legislating, you know, or coming after them and adjudicating whatever, you know, in that particular case. They had no, and they knew it, and they made it up, and their emails proved it. And, you know, the state of Pennsylvania was going after them, and they said, okay, you can have that stuff back. Didn't cost them a dime to give it all back to them. I think USC was in the same situation and passed when the, you know, the first ruling came down, and we knew the judge had seen the emails and the documents and said, you know, what he thought the NCAA had done to USC, and USC scattered and hid and didn't want to talk about it and didn't want to react to it and didn't want to respond and didn't come up with a game plan, and still allowed the NCAA to kind of, you know, that one time they practically threw Pat out of the office, you know, where he heard what, you know, the NCAA was going to do with Penn State and said, well, what about us? And they laughed at him and said, no, get out of here. And because they knew USC wasn't going to do anything, USC wasn't going to force the issue. I mean, I wish they would have. They had a, you know, there was somebody who was willing to say, totally underwrite whatever action USC chose to take against the NCAA. And I never was for, you know, trying to, you know, stop everything. And, you know, they would have held those scholarships against USC and would have used it against the program for years and years and years. But once USC had the ability to know that the NCAA had, you know, all the corruption involved and, you know, the rules breaking that the NCAA had done in order to take USC down and what they did to Todd McNair, USC probably should have at that point demanded all the documents, threatened whatever they needed to threaten in terms of getting those documents, and then, you know, come back to the NCAA with a proposal and said, this is what we're going to get back from you now, or, you know, there will be really major consequences. And they got it wrong from the beginning, and it didn't look like anybody at USC wanted to admit through this whole 5 years that, gosh, maybe we got it wrong originally. Maybe some people were right about what they said was happening here, and maybe we should have listened, but we didn't. And now we don't want to admit that we were wrong. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to get people running, you know, gigantic enterprises like USC to admit, you know, they're wrong, especially when they're out raising $6 billion, the highest, you know, the largest fundraising campaign in, at the time in, you know, higher education in America. But yeah, I would think they need to put together a demand for what they're going to ask the NCAA. And the only way you get that back is if you threaten the NCAA. I mean, Ohio State threatened them, Miami threatened them, Penn State threatened them, Oregon, they had somebody on the committee, and they just didn't agree, and they just held out and held out and held out, and the NCAA finally kind of let them off with a, you know, semi-slap on the wrist. But at Auburn, basically had the SEC behind them, and even though the NCAA knew exactly what was going on, they, you know, with Cam Newton, they just said, oh, well, we'll change. The way they changed the rules for USC to make USC more guilty, or guilty of things that weren't against the rules, with Cam Newton and Auburn, it looks like they went the other way, where they came up with a new rule that said, well, if the player himself isn't really absolutely positively aware of what may have happened, even though what may have happened might have been really against the rules, well, we won't do anything, you know. Well, and yes, he should have been aware of all that was going on and should have made, I mean, I think one of the things they could have done is taken it public way more than they did. And, you know, screamed and shouted and done everything they could have done to make the world aware. One of the problems was that even though the entire national media has turned around and realizes USC got screwed, the NCAA is wrong here, it's been hard for people to do much writing about that or talking about it just because USC hasn't defended itself. If USC would have, through this entire period, defended itself and made the case that is there to be made, it would have made it easier for other people, you know, to defend them. And they chose not to do that. And that's that's kind of sad because there are a lot of players hurt, a lot of student athletes who didn't get the college experience they should have gotten. It didn't help USC's name and brand and fan base and all of that, and USC survived it really well when you think about it. But you know, I would wish that they would use the McNair case, but right now you don't have any hope that they will, based on how they've approached the whole case.
Well, let's last topic is going to be about the about Pat Hayden and Clay Helton and potential future head coach. So let me play this voicemail question for you.
This message is for Dan Weber. I am a longtime supporter and alumnus of USC, as well as my wife. This is Dawn in Santa Barbara. I think we're getting the cart before the horse. I think we should not be worried about what our new football coach would be, but we should be interested in what our new athletic director is going to be like. I think he should have an excellent relationship with the NCAA. He should have an extensive background in a big-time program. He should formally be from one of the Big Four conferences. And he should be an individual with no ties to USC, have an excellent rapport with other athletic directors. I'm going to include this note into the president along with my donation this year, requesting that this is the time that this changes should be made. I think now, with what's been happening over the last year or two, we need a totally and complete new start. Thanks a lot.
I think, you know, I think Don is the point he makes is a good one. In terms of, you know, how do you get to a football coach if he's going to be the product of a search when there's really no confidence in the people who have been doing the searches? I mean, it's amazing. In the last 5 years, USC's had, I guess, 3 wins over top 5 programs. 2 of them by the interim coaches, after they had to fire the head coaches who had coached a whole lot more games, had 1 win between them, top 5 win. Whereas the 2 interim guys, the guys who'd, you know, been passed over or weren't, you know, considered head coaching material, you know, have 2 top 5 wins. So, you know, it's just, and, you know, the decision-making process hasn't been good. USC finds it hard, I think, to open up those processes. I mean, and one of the things, there is a culture at USC, and if you look at that campus and you look at where they're going and you look at all the things that are happening and whatever, you say, wow, this place is spectacular. They've done an unbelievable stuff, you know, in the last however many years you want to go back. I mean, I think of where you know, things were in, I guess, my first year of 2002 covering this team, and then where they are now in terms of the campus and where the, you know, the academics are and all of that kind of thing, you just say, wow, you know, you couldn't have done a whole lot better job. And yet you end up with, in terms of athletics, you end up with people who maybe haven't done such a good job. If you look at, you know, the NCAA, you know, the previous coach, you know, the basketball coach, the football coach, you know, in terms of when was it time for him to go, the coach who succeeded him, or the decision about what do you do about Coach Orgeron and his staff, and all, you know, and then what are you going to do now? And there's, you know, USC isn't that in tune. I think Don made a good point about somebody that's on, you know, a good, you know, in good standing with the NCAA. I mean, I don't know if you want to be in good standing with them, because these are not the kind of people you want to feel like, wow, I'm one of them. But you want them to respect you and maybe fear you and understand that you aren't going to take it. Like Ohio State said, when they got, you know, in the jackpot, and they basically, you know, their president said, we're not going to let you do to us what you did to USC. And the NCAA said, okay, we won't. And I think that's the kind of, you got to have a relationship, I think. And USC been a little inward looking, hasn't listened to people. They could have, for example, the Sark thing didn't have to happen. The information was available. The information was known. So they just discarded it and didn't pay attention to it. But I think there's a resistance. It's hard for me to believe that they will bring somebody in from the outside who will, as you say, start all over. That's just not how USC does things. But now they've got to figure out how do they come up with a search that has credibility based on, you know, what's happened. Because, I mean, for example, you might get the right guy, and nobody would trust you to have gotten the right guy if you do it the same way. I mean, and maybe they'll get that one phone call that's all they need, and they'll get lucky. Or maybe they'll be lucky like they did, you know, like, you know, Mike Garrett was, you know, with Pete is the fourth choice, who happens to be down here visiting his daughter on the volleyball team. And, you know, it just, they got lucky. And can you expect them? I mean, they've had enough bad luck, you know, but I'm not saying that that's probably the way you want to go out and get your football coach, is by hoping you're lucky this time. But will they go out for a new athletic director from the outside? That's a really good question. And I think, you know, if you could read, you know, Max's mind, I mean, one of the things I think before the board of trustees wasn't as long, I don't know if it's like 55 people now, and there are an awful lot of people in there that probably don't pay a lot of attention to football. And, they're not from places where they even play football. And I'm not sure. I think in the old days, maybe there were more people on that board of trustees who really did care about football. So how does, you know, and yet football still is such a big deal, especially with the unveiling of how they're going to go with the Coliseum. And we're talking about maybe $500, you know, million dollars. And that's like real money. And, you know, I think they've got to make some really good decisions. I think that's all tied in together. I think the athletic director and the future of the athletic department and the football coach and the Coliseum and all of that. And how do you get a good, you know, combination decision, of how you go forward in all those areas? And right now, I'm not sure that there is a, you know, a clear path. And it's been muddied up a little bit more, you know, with the article in the LA Times on Saturday, you know, about Pat and Hayden and the boards he serves on and how much time, you know, he's giving to those and how much he's being paid to be on those boards and what's really going on here and is he spending a lot of time. And he's earning his money, or is he not spending a lot of time, but he's still getting a lot of money? And, you know, you're getting paid $50,000 a week from USC to be the athletic director, the highest paid athletic director, you know, ever, for just, you know, the athletic director's job. I think there was somebody at Vanderbilt who was also like the chancellor of the law school that may have gotten more total compensation at one time, but nobody's ever been paid as much as, you know, as Pat is being paid, you know, to be the athletic director at USC. And, you know, for that $50,000 a week, should you get his total, you know, attention to the job? I think there are a lot of people who would say yes. You know, so there's a whole lot of issues, Don, in your, you know, in your recommendations, and is USC in a place where they can kind of, you know, implement, here's our plan, how would they come up with that plan, and who would they implement it with, and all that? I mean, I think it's a great question. It's a great suggestion. Is USC able to do something about it? I really have no idea. I mean, this is where it probably would help to have a president who had a more of a sense of college football and college athletics, and not to say, you know, that's to discredit, you know, Max in this case, but this is the case where maybe the president really does have to, you know, it's got to be his decision. And unless, you know, maybe there are you know, you could find, you know, two or three people on that board of trustees who really, really, really care about it and really, really could come up with that kind of a game plan that they could get to Max and say, here's what we think has to happen, you know, on this, you know, on this issue. And, you know, maybe, but, I'm not that, you know, optimistic that it's there to be had right now, with everything constituted the way it is right now. But, you know, you write the president, tell him what you think, how it ought to happen. And if we could get enough people to do that, that couldn't hurt.
Yeah.
That really couldn't hurt. And I think the thing we want to do is, if people get so personally involved with it, make this personal. It wasn't personal about Steve. It's not personal about Pat. It's not personal about anybody. It's what's best for USC, what's best for these athletes, what's best for the college community, the university at large, what's best for the, you know, the students, what's best for the alumni, the fan base. I mean, I think, you know, there's an obligation to all of those, you know, communities. And I think USC has to do right by them. And it can't just be personally. I mean, that was one of the things I thought where people got off the track is like, well, what about, you know, I know this is going to really hurt Sark, or, you know, or people will say, this is really not fair to Pat. And I think there are times when it's way more than just any one, you know, person, that it's really about a lot more than that. And, but, you know, on the, like, you read the Peristyle some days and it all becomes personal and it all becomes, you know, really argumentative about that kind of thing. And I don't know that has any place here. It's just, you know, calmly thinking about what really is the best way to to get through this and to come up with the best answers and the best results for USC and not take it, you know, where, you know, you're a hater or you're a this or you're a that if you say this. It's let's just try to figure this out and see how we can get it done.
Chad P. from Tustin kind of had a similar question. So thanks, Chad, for sending that in. We won't talk about Hayden anymore. I wanted to talk about try to get to the head coaching stuff. We had two kind of questions from either side of this, and I think it's a good way to frame this for you, Dan. I'll read both of them. Steven said, is there any advantage to hiring a quote-unquote big-name coach over naming Clay Helton as a head coach, giving the team continues to play and respond the way they do, and they did at times during the Notre Dame game and the entirety of the Utah game. In both games, USC came from behind and actually showed it could be competitive. And then Stephen Portland kind of has a different take. He says, I feel like it's Groundhog Day 2013 all over again. Let me say I'm very appreciative of the job Coach Helton has done under difficult circumstances. That said, I'm not sure why people want to hire him, even if USC happens to win out. USC is a top five job and deserves a top five coach. There's no reason to make an emotional hire and sell the program short just because he rallied the troops for half a season. I think my main trepidation with the possible hiring of Helton is fear we'll end up with the same staff currently in place. I think he would have to make wholesale changes to the staff to be successful and not just bring back old Kiffin assistants from 2013. What are your thoughts? Thanks and fight on. So that's Stephen Portland, and then Stephen had the other take.
Well, I mean, I think the coaching search goes in three levels here as far as I'm concerned. I think you have the, you know, the really big splash, big name, somebody who would immediately kick off the, you know, the 2016 season, which is already going to kick off with Nick Saban in Alabama. You know, I think the classic example there is say Pete Carroll, no matter what anybody says, let's say Pete Carroll, after slogging through this season in Seattle, says, you know, unless I want to be Bill Belichick, unless I want to, you know, do whatever deal he's made with the devil to, you know, try to stay on top year after year after year in a league where all the rules are designed to not let you do that, you know, from the draft to the, you know, the whole salary cap and all the other stuff. What if Pete said, you know, and somebody made the case to Pete, look, you would impact our fundraising so much for the Coliseum, you'd be the guy in LA again. You'd have a team at, you know, your first year. You could do something nobody in the history of coaching football, from Newt Rockne to Bear Bryant to anybody, has ever been able to manage to win national championships in college, go to the NFL, win the Super Bowl, should have won it twice, and then come back and do it again in college. And, you know, give the, you know, big middle finger to the NCAA as well, and maybe do it in your first year back. So that's the one, the big splashy, you know, hire that you just don't, you know, does that guy exist? Does Pete exist, you know, for that purpose? Or is there that guy, that John Harbaugh or whatever, who just decides, you know, I'm getting $7 million a year to coach the Ravens, but what the heck, this is crazy. I'll, you know, so you get that. That's the one way you look at it. The other way you look at it are the two next probably great coaches in college football, and Tom Herman at Houston and Justin Fuente at Memphis. And they're the, you know, not that young, you know, but, you know, early 40s guys who've proven themselves as much as you can possibly prove yourself at their age and with their experience. And, you know, are they tainted because Sark and Lane have tainted, you know, that kind of a guy, not enough experience? Sort of, you know, I don't think so at all. I think they're both going to be absolutely great, big time, extremely successful college coaches who could be successful at USC. I don't think there's any question. So that's the other, you know, train. And then you've got the, you know, the Clay Helton. What if he does win out? What if he does, you know, get them to the championship game? What if they get Stanford and this time, you know, they didn't have to play a whole lot better that they could have been in that game. And they probably will be a whole lot better if that scenario happens. Then what do you do? You know, how does the Ed Orgeron situation play into, you know, at this time? I mean, if you look at, you know, Kiffin and Sark and say, well, that, you know, does this for, you know, the young coaches, or, you know, you look at the Ed Orgeron thing and said, you know, we'd have been better off, you know, we'd have saved $7 million in transition costs, and we've been a whole lot better off, you know, staff-wise and everything else, and embarrassment-wise and what have you, if we'd have kept that in place and we didn't have to make a decision. So you got kind of, I think, three ways to look at it. And I don't think those are decisions that have to be made now. I think somebody ought to be doing a lot of talking to qualify everybody that can be qualified. And, I mean, really take it, you know, into your own hands, whoever's, the question is, who at USC can do this right now? Who is that guy that can make those calls and find out, really, you know, we don't want you just using us to get a raise and all that. We really, and getting to know these people well enough so you could really, you know, understand who is there. And then you eventually have to pull the trigger and you say, this is the guy of all the people we've talked to, of all the people we considered, and we've given them all a fair shot. And we really, really want to know him and understand him. And this is the guy, whether he's an NFL guy, whether he's a big name, or whether he's the next big name, or whether he's the guy who gets you out of, you know, an unbelievably difficult situation this year at USC, you say, this is the best guy for this program right at this time. And that's, you know, that's not necessarily a quantitative decision where you, you know, check the boxes on how many years experience he's got or how many wins he's got. It's kind of a feel, a sense of, this guy fits this program perfectly. Who's the one that has to, you know, have that feel? Who's the one that's going to have that sense of, I mean, I think you know, Ryan and I, we think we know a lot about college football. I don't think I right now would have any idea who for sure would be that guy. I mean, I just think, you know, until you sit down with these guys and you really get the feel of who they are and how they would approach this job. I mean, I'm really impressed with, you know, some of the people that are available. I was not that impressed last time. 2 years ago, it just didn't seem like that cycle had the people that, you know, and you look now at some of the names and you think, you know, I'm not sure that they would have been the right guy. who got passed over, and we're not really sure that anybody really got a good look other than Sark. And obviously that's not the way to go. But, you know, I just think there are a lot of good candidates, but I don't think you can make you absolutely can't make a judgment on Clay Helton now. Obviously, you know, had they been better, would they be better off had Ed stayed? Yes. Would they be better off had Clay Helton stayed after the Las Vegas Bowl? Yes. You know, they didn't, you know, didn't go that way. It's amazing he's gotten another chance. I mean, you obviously see what's happened in just a couple of weeks with having a really focused, professional, you know, head coach who's not got anything other, you know, going on other than how do I coach this football team and what kind of relationships do I have with my players, and you see what happens. Is that enough for USC? I mean, one of the standards is when Alabama was in trouble, they went and hired Nick Saban. Ohio State was in trouble, they went and hired Urban Meyer. Michigan's in trouble, they go out and hire Jim Harbaugh. Where does USC fit in that picture? There would be, you know, a lot of people who would say, you know, USC's equal or better in terms of history and tradition and impact and, you know, the football program of any of those. And none of those thought they couldn't go out and get the absolutely perfect guy, you know, for their program. Why can't USC? I mean, I think that's got to be, you know, the standard. Now, what does that mean is the question. What is that perfect guy, and how do you get to him? But I don't think they should back off. For, you know, if somebody would say, give Pete Carroll $10 million, make him the highest-paid coach ever and do all that kind of thing, and whether that actually would impact Pete or not, I don't know. But you might find out, and you say, hey, you know, in terms of fundraising, immediate fundraising for the Coliseum, that would be paid off over and over and over again, you know, with the enthusiasm of, you know, of where that would take you. Is that the right way to go? I mean, I don't know that we know that absolutely for sure, but, you know, it's a way, you know, you don't limit yourself. I don't think USC should limit itself the way they did with the Sark hiring, or even with the Lane Kiffin. I think there was such a focus on, oh, we've got to save the recruiting class. And I think we've learned since then that USC recruits for itself. USC recruits itself. You know, I mean, I think Sark came to USC and all of a sudden he became an absolutely great recruiter. And you know, not to denigrate any of that, USC's the great recruiter here. And so I don't think they should make any calls based on, and we're not seeing that as much this time, based on recruiting, or, you know, immediate impact and that kind of thing. USC is going to be fine, recruiting. Hey, they recruited great in the 90s. You know, I mean, I think when a lot, you know, when I started, you had Carson Palmer and Troy Polamalu, you know, recruited by, you know, Paul Hackett. So USC can recruit.
Yeah.
But now they got to figure out, you know, and recruit the next coach. And that doesn't come as easily.
Yep, that's the biggest recruiting job of all.
Yep.
But thanks, Dan. Great stuff. We got a lot to get to. And so hopefully everyone enjoyed the show. And thanks for getting everyone's questions. I know there was a lot of stuff there, but USC focused on Cal this week. We'll talk to you more this week during practice, Dan, about the Cal game and how this team moves forward. But thanks again for coming on.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. And, man, love the questions. Keep them coming, you guys.
Yeah, great stuff. And thanks, everyone else, for tuning into the Peristyle podcast. I'm going to try to do – we'll do like a preview show this week. I might do a solo one with some of the other questions. So check back on peristylepodcast.com. We'll talk to you next time. And here's a quick message from Michael Moline Real Estate.
Most people know that buying or selling real estate is no small undertaking. Understanding the market value of your home, pricing, advertising, closing, and perhaps even selling personal property along the way are all examples of the real estate journey. And Michael Moline Real Estate has the experience to help make that journey an enjoyable one. Southern California real estate inventories are at historic lows, so there is no better time than now to sell your residential property. Whether you're moving into a bigger home or downsizing, personal property is often a component of the real estate estate transaction. Michael Moline Real Estate has industry expertise to help you with both your real property and your personal property as you get ready to transition. Michael Moline Real Estate specializes in properties located on the west side of Los Angeles and the southern San Fernando Valley communities. Allow Michael Moline Real Estate to give you a free comparative market analysis and home valuation so you know how much your home is worth today. Contact Michael Moline at michaelmolinerealestate.com. That's Michael, M-O-L-I-N-E, realestate.com.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by uscfootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.